December 2020, primary. Hello and welcome once again to the St Albans and District Talking Newspaper, serving St Albans, Harpenden and the surrounding areas. This is the primary edition for the week ending 5th of December 2020. My name is Ian, I edit and produce this programme. Well, we've just surfaced from a second lockdown and have gone straight into Tier 2. It's more restrictive than before, but at least I can go to my gym, even if I can't have just a pint at my local pub. Goodness knows what will happen with the Christmas relaxation of the restrictions. Utter madness, in my humble and purely personal opinion. At least there are hopeful signs with the announcements this week of the approval of the Pfizer vaccine. This edition of Primary will again be distributed on USB sticks. Please remember to return them in the wallet provided when you have finished listening. It helps us all enormously. Additionally, the programme is available on our website, sadtn.org.uk, under Listen Online. If you're using a mobile device, it's available via the British Wireless for the Blind Fund app. This can be downloaded free via iTunes or Google Play. Search for Talking Newspaper. Once you've installed the app, open it up, select East of England, then scroll down until you find the two entries for St Albans. You can also hear the news from the Hertfordshire Advertiser and the Review on Radio Verulam, 92.6 FM, in a programme ably hosted by our very own Rob Pearman on Sunday, 8 to 9am and 6 to 7pm, and on Wednesday at 7pm. This edition also sees the return, on the USB stick distribution only, of the BBC In Touch podcast. We'll also have the usual news roundup, and the national radio listings read by John Cushing. Once again, we'll be delving into the Vocalise London Beyond Sight archives. This time it's St Pancras Station. I'll also be playing an American Vocalise piece. Children's book expert Leonard Marcus describes my favourite bridge in all of New York, the fantastic Brooklyn Bridge. And Rob Pearman talks to Sarah Keeling, curator of St Albans Museum and Gallery, about how COVID-19, the lockdown, and the new restrictions have affected them. Rob will also be talking to Denise Parsons, the manager of St Albans BID, that's the Business Improvement District, about the prospects for the retail and hospitality sectors now we know we are in Tier 2. To finish, I'll be looking at past events and birthdays in the week. This week's music is Words by Gothby. But first the news, read by Jilly, Deborah, Christine, Jane, Jess, Andy, Keith, and David.
Hello, I'm Jilly. This story is from The Review. Mass COVID vaccination centre being set up in Hertfordshire town. Plans for the creation of a hub to vaccinate potentially thousands of people is believed to be underway in a Hertfordshire town. The leader of Stevenage Borough Council, Sharon Taylor, has tweeted today that a COVID-19 vaccination centre is coming to Stevenage. Councillor Taylor said there would be more information to come, but it is understood the location of the hub would be Robertson House in Gunnell's Wood Road. This morning, Health Secretary Matt Hancock announced the UK had become the first country in the world to approve a jab from Pfizer and BioNTech. The vaccine, approved by the Independent Medicines and Healthcare Products Regulatory Agency, MHRA, has been shown in studies to be 95% effective. The Joint Committee on Vaccination and Immunisation, JCVI, which advises ministers, said vaccines should first be offered to elderly people in care homes and care home workers. Next on the priority list are those aged 80 and above and frontline health workers. Doses are understood to have been made available to staff at both West Hertfordshire Hospitals NHS Trust and East and North Hertfordshire NHS Trust. all those aged 75 and over should be vaccinated next, followed by those 70 and over and clinically extremely vulnerable individuals, it said. The UK has ordered 40 million doses of the Pfizer vaccine, enough to vaccinate 20 million people with two doses given 21 days apart. Health Secretary Matt Hancock said 800,000 doses of the jab will arrive next week, with millions more arriving in the coming weeks. But Mr. Hancock admitted he is unsure how many Britons will need to receive a COVID-19 vaccine before restrictions can be lifted. He said that while it is known the vaccine protects you as an individual, it is unclear what impact it has on reducing the transmission of COVID-19. Lockdown restrictions were lifted in England today, with Hertfordshire heading into high alert tier 2 restrictions, despite a county-wide decline in cases over the last week or so. Hertfordshire County Council reported the county's latest infection rate over a 7-day period is 113.7, which is down 21.9% on the previous 7-day rate. But cases are higher in some districts, including Watford, Hartsmere and Broxbourne.
Hello, this is Andy. And in this story from The Review, Townsend School in St Albans closed after COVID-19 cases. A secondary school is likely to be closed for at least a week after a number of positive coronavirus tests. Townsend Church of England School in St Albans said both staff and students have tested positive for COVID-19 in an update on its website. The school, in High Oaks in the north of the city, is not planning to reopen until at least Wednesday, December the 9th. The update, published on the school website on Tuesday, December 1st, revealed pupils in several years have received positive tests. It read, "We have now received information from staff and parents and carers that a number of tests were taken yesterday and have returned as positive. Five staff have positive tests and others are going for tests today. We now have information that five students in year 11, one in year 9, two in year 10 and four in year 7 have also tested positive, with others being notified to us as every hour passes. Our school attendance today details under 40% of each year group being in school as families take a decision to self-isolate. The decision to shut has come following advice from public health officials." The update continued, "We have again assessed our situation and believe that when all the above information is considered, we have no option but to close our school to increase the safety for our students and staff, for all year groups and all staff. This will be for an initial period of 1 week while we further assess the infection rate and take further advice from Hertfordshire County Council and Public Health England. We would therefore be planning to open again on Wednesday, December the 9th. We have not taken this decision lightly, and once again, thank you for your support. We've always maintained the safety of our school community remains our priority, and right now we are in a position where we judge the risks for this community are too high. Pupils will study at home while the school remains closed." The closure of Townsend comes after Marlborough Science Academy took the decision to shut last week. Head teacher Annie Thompson said, "There was no other way to keep us all safe but to shut the school. After coronavirus cases in several year groups, with more than 30 teachers self-isolating."
Hello, my name's Deborah, and my first article is entitled "Charities Face Uncertainty on Funding Over Grant Changes." Changes to the way charities are funded by St Albans District Council have been condemned for creating further uncertainty in the midst of the coronavirus crisis. The council has abolished three-year grants provided by the Community Partnerships Fund, meaning charities must now reapply every year to the council for grants. Conservative group leader Councillor Mary Maynard said, "As someone who has helped run children's charities for over 20 years, I am well aware of the difficulties they face in having reliable sources of funds over a long period. St Albans and District Council has introduced major uncertainty to key local charities by abolishing the three-year grants introduced by the previous Conservative administration. By doing this, they are increasing stress and uncertainty in the charities and impacting the lives of our most vulnerable residents. This is particularly harsh, given the problems charities face during COVID." In response, Council leader and Lib Dem councillor Chris White said, "Upon review and feedback from grants recipients, the fund was seen to have a lack of transparency and flexibility. It was noted in the review that the current three-year funding did not allow some groups to be responsive in their delivery, and there were examples of funded projects becoming out of date after a year. This produced more work for groups in terms of monitoring and renegotiation of desired outcomes." He added, "Two of the groups this grant has previously funded have been moved to strategic funding, which remains a three-year grant, St Albans Women's Refuge and Hightown Mother and Baby. The remaining organisations funded previously have all been consulted, and many provided feedback as part of the review. This includes St Albans District Food Bank, Living Room and Homestart, who all had sight of the proposed structure and processes. They will be able to apply for the new Community Revenue Grant, a new grant that will fund general running costs of organisations which provide services in the district which are considered of value. Although it is one-year funding, it can be renewed through a simple reapplication process on evidence of meeting outcomes and providing monitoring. This allows for greater flexibility, as groups can amend their delivery each year according to current needs, and there is opportunity to apply for more or less than the previous year, which gives better value for money."
This is Keith McDougall. The Westminster Diary, as St Albans MP Daisy Cooper offers her take on a week in Westminster. "Lots of residents have been anxiously asking me what's going to happen after the national lockdown. And this week, the government announced its plans for a tougher three-tier system. Under government plans, St Albans will be in Tier 2, high alert, and the new restrictions will be tougher and tighter than before. Lots of you have written to me asking what this will mean for your lives, jobs and businesses. As always, it's taking longer than it should for the official advice from the government to arrive. What we do know is that in Tier 2, we still can't mix with other households indoors, except where we're in a support bubble. But gyms, cinemas, theatres and retail will be allowed to open again, with social distancing and other COVID-secure measures, of course. We can also see a return of spectators to football matches, albeit with a much reduced capacity. That's good news for the Odyssey Cinema, the Maltings Theatre and, hopefully, for City fans, as the club hopes to roll out a phased return of its supporters. What's heartbreaking, though, is that the restrictions for hospitality and pubs are likely to devastate many local businesses. The baseless 10 p.m. curfew has been partially changed, and some restaurants should now be able to return to offering a second dinner sitting, which could be a lifeline in difficult times. But I'm hearing of publicans and their teams in states of genuine distress. In many community pubs, the landlord or their staff live above the premises. When those businesses hit trouble, people don't just lose an income, they lose their family home. Our local community pubs and bars rely on Christmas to see them through winter and the quieter months of the new year, and that income is going to be hit hard this year. On top of that, they're already out of pocket, having already invested so much in COVID measures and stock that's going to waste. I'm continuing to fight their corner to demand that restrictions are matched with real support from the government. Looking ahead, there's a lot hanging in the balance. The number of COVID cases in Hertfordshire is still high, but they're starting to fall quite quickly. What impact the new tier system, the flu season, the return of university students, and the relaxation of rules at Christmas will have in the next 4 weeks is yet to be seen.
Hello, this is Jane Wilson. My first piece today is entitled "Voles are set for return to the River Ver." absent from its waters since 1987, one of the UK's most endangered wildlife is set to make a long-awaited return to the River Ver next year. The water vole, one of the country's fastest declining mammals, will be reintroduced to the Ver Valley between St Albans and Redbourne in May. The initiative is the result of a partnership between Herts and Middlesex Wildlife Trust, the Ver Valley Society and local river owners, funded by animal welfare charity the Debs Foundation. Since the 1950s, water vole populations have decreased by over 90%. But this stretch of the Ver offers the perfect conditions for the creatures: dense bankside vegetation and clean water. Tim Hill, conservation manager at the Trust, says, "This is a major breakthrough for wildlife in the Ver Valley. Water voles are Britain's fastest declining mammal and need our help now. But it's not too late to bring them back from the brink, as this and other projects in the area prove."
Hello, David Ireson. Herts and Middlesex Wildlife Trust, HMWT, working alongside the Ver Valley Society and local river owners, will be bringing the animals to the Ver Valley north of St Albans, the first time they will have been seen in the river since 1987. Around 150 water voles will be reintroduced to this stretch of the Ver as part of an ambitious programme to expand the territory of the animals in the county. The habitat in that stretch of river provides the perfect conditions for water voles: dense bankside vegetation and clean water. Water voles, typically found in healthy chalk rivers, are under serious threat from habitat loss. The majority of England's rivers are polluted and of poor ecological quality. Since the 1950s, water vole populations have decreased by over 90%. HMWT conservation manager Tim Hill explained, "This is a major breakthrough for wildlife in the Ver Valley. Water voles are Britain's fastest declining mammal and need our help now, but it's not too late to bring them back from the brink, as this and the other projects in the area prove." The project is funded by the Debs Foundation, a charitable trust that supports animal welfare and wildlife charities. David Kittleson from the foundation said, "We are delighted to award a grant to Herts and Middlesex Wildlife Trust for a major programme to introduce the water vole to the River Ver. We believe it is important to help save this endangered animal, and we are very impressed with the planning done for the scheme. We very much look forward to working with the Trust and the Ver Valley Society, who have been so supportive." HMWT is working with landowners, including Gorhambury Estate, as well as Ver Valley Society, who are keen to see water voles in the river again. Ver Valley Society Chairman John Pritchard added, "Our society has been working hard for years to enhance the environment through practical works and lobbying for restoration of the Ver. Bringing back water voles to the Ver Valley is recognition of the quality of the habitat and capitalises on the prospect of improved flows." And there's a picture with the article showing Herts and Middlesex Wildlife Trust conservation manager Tim Hill with Paul Barnes, John Pritchard from the Ver Valley Society and David Giddleston from the Debs Foundation, all standing by the bank of the river.
Hello, my name's Jessica. Postbox Toppers are back for their third Christmas. The third time's the charm. St Albans' much-loved postboxes, Toppers, are back for another Christmas, pandemic be damned. After months of planning and organisation, 50 decorated postboxes are now ready for the festive season. This is only possible thanks to the fantastic efforts of the talented, creative and dedicated yarn bombing team led by Candy Stewart. All the toppers have been made by knitting volunteers, but there are also various other people who have donated their time and expertise behind the scenes, including web designers, map artists, bloggers and photographers. This year's postboxes support two local charities, homeless support organisation Open Door and St Albans and District Food Bank. In addition to hosting and building the website, creating the logo and doing the technical magic to make everything appear on the Eyes on St Albans app, Digital Gen have sponsored the Scan and Win Trail. Prizes include a 4.5 kilogram Toblerone, a chocolate hamper, a Lego caravan, and a £250 St Albans gift card. Every time you find one of the postbox toppers, you can scan the trail code, one scan per postbox per 24 hours, to gain one entry into the draw. Sponsors this year come from many areas of the community: a church, community groups, a running group, market stalls, pubs, accountants, a tree surgeon, and many more. Organiser Claire City said, "The response from the community has been so positive. There was a real buzz before launch with excitement building. We lost count of all the people who told us how much they'd been looking forward to the toppers going up and how much they enjoy finding them all every year. This is a safe activity and fun for all the family, and we certainly need that at the end of this year." Food bank manager Emma Dalton said, "Any support you can give us will go straight back to the poorest in our community to help those who cannot afford the basic essentials to live their lives with dignity and without hunger. So far, over £5,200 has been raised by this year's toppers."
Hello, my name's Christine Stanley. The zoo gets into the Christmas spirit post-lockdown. Whipsnade Zoo is ready to bring Christmas cheer to the whole family this festive season in the wake of the second lockdown. From this Saturday right through to Christmas Eve, Whipsnade is inviting families to journey through the wild wonderland on a self-guided trail around the zoo. This is to enable you to hunt for clues to help find the lost food for Santa's reindeer. You'll discover fascinating facts and see amazing animals along the way. It wouldn't be Christmas without the man in red himself, and children will be able to see him during the daily Santa parade on his festive float around the zoo. The 600-acre nature haven will remain open regardless of which tier the county is in, meaning that visitors can book with confidence for a guaranteed festive family day out with the usual social distancing restrictions in place. Whipsnade Zoo's Chief Operating Officer, Owen Kraft, said, "Christmas at Whipsnade Zoo is always magical, with our huge winter wonderland to explore. But this year, we all need a little extra magic, so we're really excited to be able to still bring Father Christmas to our visitors. It's been a difficult year for us all, and paying us a visit is one of the best ways you can to show your support. I can't think of a better place to be this Christmas." And there are stunning photos of zebras and rhinos silhouetted against the morning fog. These were captured by zookeepers Phil Curzon and James Ford ahead of the zoo's reopening this week. Snapped while on their morning rounds, the keepers' misty shots highlight the beautiful landscape and amazing animals at the UK's largest zoo. Fundraised from Christmas visits will help international conservation charity ZSL, that's Zoological Society of London, which runs London Zoo and Whipsnade, to continue to care for the 20,000 residents at its two zoos and protect the threatened species around the world.
The reimagined St Albans fireworks display has presented a record amount to charity after the community rallied round a crowdfunding campaign. On Saturday, November the 7th, the sky was lit up with a stunning firework display organised by a volunteer committee at St Albans Cathedral. Look Up Together was a 10-minute simultaneous display from secret sites across the city, which wowed people from their homes. The annual event, which usually attracts up to 20,000 people to Verulamium Park, was reimagined this year due to the pandemic, and following a successful crowdfunding campaign, a record £30,000 has been given to the nominated charities. Paul Dean of St Albans Cathedral said, "Last year's event was a washout, meaning we couldn't give any money to charity, so to be able to donate a record amount in such a challenging year for us all has been truly fabulous."
In this story from the Review, Hertfordshire council leader responds to Tier 2 lockdown news. A council leader has urged people to redouble our efforts, with Hertfordshire set to be placed in Tier 2 when the lockdown ends. David Williams, leader of Hertfordshire County Council, hopes a downward trend of cases in the county continues so it moves back to Tier 1 as soon as possible. Before the full lockdown was imposed on November the 5th, Hertfordshire had been placed in Tier 1, but had been on the verge of moving into Tier 2. It was expected that Hertfordshire would face stricter restrictions after the second lockdown, with most areas in the county still reporting more than 100 cases per week per 100,000 population. Case rates have dropped over the last week, but most districts in the county remain higher than what they had been under the tier system in October. Mr. Williams said, "We have been in ongoing dialogue with the government, and this decision is based on a series of indicators that reflect the continued prevalence of the virus in the county. In recent weeks, we have been working closely with the NHS and Hertfordshire's district and borough councils in preparation for the end of the national lockdown. As such, we are well prepared to continue supporting our communities to come through the new level of restrictions. We understand that being in Tier 2 will bring concerns for many. These will include the restriction on socialising with anyone you do not live with or who is not in your support bubble in any indoor setting, as well as the economic consequences, especially for our hospitality sector. So now it is more important than ever that we redouble our efforts to ensure that the recent downward trend in our infection rates is sustained in order to secure a move to Tier 1 as soon as possible." He added, "I would like to extend my sincere thanks to all Hertfordshire residents who have continued to play their part over the last month by adhering to the national restrictions. However, the virus is still circulating widely in the community, and we must not let our guard down in the run-up to the festive period. The recent announcement of a vaccine marks a significant step forward in the fight against COVID-19. Yet we cannot afford to be complacent. We must all continue to take responsibility to lower the risk in our day-to-day lives by playing our part, keeping up the basics of hand washing, social distancing, and wearing face masks, getting a test if you develop symptoms, and self-isolating when required. And now, following the restrictions which apply to Tier 2. Watford Mayor Peter Taylor urged people in the borough to do what we can. He said, "Despite seeing a plateau in the number of cases locally, the numbers are still higher than where we want them to be." Watford MP Dean Russell said, "As more of us will be heading out to do Christmas shopping and eat in restaurants, it's more important than ever that we wear face coverings when required, regularly wash our hands and maintain social distancing. 2020 has been a tough year, but the news of a number of potential vaccines gives us reason for cautious hope that there is light at the end of this tunnel, and I would like to thank everybody that has had to make tough sacrifices already this year."
Live nativity event bringing Christmas magic to Baptist Church. A city centre church is set to transform into a magical animal wonderland to recapture the magic of the first Christmas. Dagnall Street Baptist Church will host its Messy Church event with the help of Ark Farm, who bring farm animals into schools, children's centres and care homes. The event runs from 10:30 a.m. to 12:30 p.m. on Saturday, December the 12th. The church will be filling its outside area with festive fun and inviting the people of St Albans to drop by and experience what it would have been like in the stable for the Nativity, bringing the story of the very first Christmas to life in an event the whole family can enjoy. Visitors can meet, pet and learn about the animals, including a donkey, some sheep, chickens, geese and goats. This year's event will follow careful social distancing guidelines, but keep all of the fun visitors will have experienced in previous years. After meeting the animals, visitors can enjoy refreshments and a nativity trail before collecting their very own goodie bag. The Animal Magic event is part of Dagnall Street's successful Messy Church, a fun-filled way for families to spend quality time together. Our Animal Farmyard Fun Messy Church is a wonderful way to start the festive season and much needed after a challenging year, said the Reverend Simon Carver. As we look towards Christmas, many of us are focused on embracing our family and remembering what is important to us, perhaps even more than in previous years. We want to share with everyone the story behind the holiday, and we welcome you to come down, enjoy the fun, and find out more. Dagnall Street Baptist, one of the oldest Baptist churches in the country, is located on Upper Dagnall Street in the city centre, opposite the entrance to Christopher Place car park. It has run Messy Church since 2011, providing a fun and welcoming space to hundreds of St Albans families.
Pub in the Park's festive theatre is on its way to us. Pub in the Park's latest fully COVID-compliant experience is coming to Hertfordshire this Christmas, with a programme featuring festive films, food, comedy, dance and carols. From the team behind Tom Kerridge's Pub in the Park Food and Music Festival in St Albans, this summer's Drive and Dine Theatre at the Luton Hoo Estate and the Drive-In Garden Party at Nebworth House comes Pub in the Park's festive theatre. Taking place in pop-up indoor theatres, this seasonal extravaganza will be full of much-needed festive cheer for the whole family, and it can be enjoyed at the Hertfordshire Showground in Redbourne from Friday, December the 11th to Wednesday, December the 23rd. Pub in the Park's festive theatre will feature an extra special run of festive films, including Christmas classics Love Actually, The Holiday, Elf, Miracle on 34th Street, Die Hard and It's a Wonderful Life. Family favourites The Greatest Showman, Back to the Future, Paddington and Bohemian Rhapsody are also on the Hart Showground Cinema programme. If you fancy a bit of a giggle, then stand-up comedy will come from Mark Watson's Christmas Comedy Club, with live performances from Ed Byrne and Angela Barnes. Having sung at Harry and Meghan's wedding, the Kingdom Choir will also be performing a special Christmas carol concert. The incredible choir, led by Karen Gibson MBE, will be giving show-stopping performances of festive favourites, including Hark the Herald Angels Sing, Silent Night and Joy to the World. For fans of Strictly Come Dancing, siblings Kevin and Joanne Clifton will be taking to the stage to sing, dance and tell the tales of their glittering professional careers. Strictly champion Kevin Clifton said, "We're so excited to be joining Pub in the Park's festive theatre with a version of our tour, especially as we've had to postpone the main tour to 2021. Expect high-energy dances, humorous stories and a few songs. Joe and I can't wait." Following the latest detailed government guidelines and designed for safety and security, Pub in the Park's festive theatre will provide Christmas entertainment in a contact-free, socially distanced and safe environment. Each group of ticket holders will enjoy their chosen entertainment from the comfort and safety of their own pod. With seating for up to six per pod, parties will be spaced out in a large area in front of the big screen or stage. A Pub in the Park newsletter stated, "We'll be creating a pop-up covered theatre for you to enjoy a spectacular show. You can attend the performance of your choice in groups of up to six, subject to the latest government guidelines, settling into your very own socially distanced pod. Expect warm festive vibes, the perfect treat for you and your loved ones this Christmas." St Albans tickets will include entry to the show of your choice, plus a hearty two-course meal created by Michelin-starred Atul Kokkar. Atul will be serving his famous butter chicken with your food and drink delivered straight to your pod. The chef said, "I've worked with Tom and the Pub in the Park team for a number of years now and have loved being involved in all of their events. I cannot wait for this one, especially as it has been such a hard year for us all. I'm looking forward to presenting a delicious menu to match the brilliant entertainment that the team has curated." Tom Kerridge will create the menu at Festive Theatre's other location at Bicester Heritage. He will serve his take on a classic chili con carne. Kerridge said, "I'm super excited to be involved in Pub in the Park's Festive Theatre. Come and eat some great grub with a menu curated by me and my team, or my good pal Atul, whilst watching a classic Christmas movie, singing along to your favourite festive tune, tapping your feet to some dance legends, or laughing your socks off to some of the funniest talent in the UK. Pub in the Park's festive theatre is suitable for all ages, with both daytime and evening viewings. Tickets went on sale on Tuesday, December the 1st.
Peter Pan will fly for children this season. Following the news that Hertfordshire has been placed in Tier 2, creatives at the Maltings Theatre have confirmed that their forthcoming production of Peter Pan will go ahead as planned this Christmas. Relieved producers of the musical, based on J.M. Barrie's timeless tale, have confirmed that the company's magical production will open on schedule at the Auburn Arena on Friday, December the 11th. There will be 38 performances of Peter Pan at the St. Albans venue in total from December the 11th until January the 3rd, 2021. The energetic 15-strong cast is currently in rehearsal for what promises to be a spectacular festive show for all the family. One of the only festive productions taking place live on stage in the county this Christmas, Peter Pan is produced by OVO, the company who have been creating and presenting sell-out shows at the open-air Roman Theatre of Verulamium in St Albans and indoors at the Maltings Theatre throughout this COVID-crazy year. Adam Nichols, director of Peter Pan, an artistic director of OVO and the Maltings Theatre, said, "I'm delighted that our superb production of Peter Pan can open to audiences as planned. We are already implementing strictly monitored safety arrangements at the Auburn Arena. The production itself has been designed to incorporate all social distancing requirements, which will result in some lovely comedic moments. Most importantly, this is the fifth production OVO has mounted during the pandemic. We've built up a substantial body of expertise in ensuring rehearsals and what happens both on and off stage in performance is safe, while not compromising the audience expectation and experience of attending live theatre. We're all very excited about opening Peter Pan, and we're looking forward to welcoming audiences throughout the festive season. Tickets are selling fast, and each performance will seat around 40% of the Auburn Arena's normal capacity. Audiences will have their seats confirmed by email and will be asked to arrive at different times in order to avoid any crowding on arrival. There will be interval drinks and snacks available at the bars, although ticket buyers will be invited to order drinks in advance. The cast of Peter Pan features many of the popular actors who featured in OVO's recent productions indoors at the Maltings Theatre in St Albans and outdoors at the Roman Theatre. When the leader of the Lost Boys, Peter Pan, loses his shadow during a visit to London, headstrong Wendy helps him reattach it. In return, Peter invites Wendy to fly away with him to Neverland, a mystical world of mischievous lost children and boundless dreams, far beyond her urban reality. But there's danger lurking. Neverland is also a place of malicious mermaids, feisty fairies, fearsome female warriors, and the vengeful and devious pirate, Captain Hook. And a hungry crocodile. Can Wendy defeat them to save her new friends? The cast of Peter Pan includes Felipe Pacheco, who had multiple roles in the Maltings production of Henry V in the title role of The Boy Who Couldn't Grow Up, and Flora Squires from the 39 Steps and Merry Wives as Wendy Darling. Anna Franklin, seen in Merry Wives and the Regina monologues, plays the narrator, while Emma Wright, Merry Wives and Twelfth Night, is Mary Darling. The cast also includes Joe Servi, Merry Wives, as Gentleman Starkey, Matthew Parker, the award-winning director of Henry V, as Nana and Smee, and Will Pattle from Merry Wives as Michael Darling. Tickets are available from ticketsource.co.uk/OVO, and that's O-V-O.
Abuse Survivor backs Days of Action campaign, an item in the Hearts ad by Georgia Barrow. A Hearts Domestic Abuse Helpline service user has explained the importance of support in the workplace, raising awareness of the 16 Days of Action campaign. Last Wednesday saw the start of 16 Days of Action, which encourages employers to spot the signs of domestic abuse within their own teams. In line with the campaign, the Hearts Helpline is shining a spotlight on how employers can be part of the community response against domestic abuse. Jane, not her real name, was followed to work by her abusive husband of 18 years and managed to gain the support of her manager. She said, "I had experienced domestic abuse throughout my 18 years of marriage, but it escalated when my partner Henry started chatting to women on social media. At the time, I was working part-time for a company that required me to travel to different locations. My partner became increasingly paranoid and convinced himself that I was also using social media to meet other people. He had a night shift and got home around 6 a.m. when I would then take the car to go to work. He started to hide the car keys, so I had to ring in sick. I'd never rung in sick before. He then changed his shift work so that it ended at midday to ensure that I couldn't meet work colleagues for breakfast anymore. I was forced to change my working hours. He was isolating me from my co-workers and friends. I shared what was happening with my sister, and she purchased a cheap old banger to get me to work in the morning and back to my old routine. That's when the workplace stalking and harassment started. Henry would drive to the car park to watch if I was leaving work with anyone. One time I got into the car and started to send a text, not realizing that he was looking through the window to see who I was texting. He opened the door and grabbed my phone to check it. I still had to go on to my next location visit and do my job as if nothing had happened. I started to make a lot of mistakes in my job. I was constantly on edge, hyper-vigilant and worried. A couple of times I would have someone approach me at work to ask a question and I would jump out of my skin. I was afraid to talk to anyone male at work in case Henry was watching. I had constant texts all day at work, ranging from loving ones to threatening ones, all within minutes of each other. Jane eventually informed her manager and was given time off to attend the Freedom Program. I got a non-molestation order, but my employer put in no procedures to ensure I was safe at work, Jane continued. Looking back, it would have been so valuable for me to have known from my employer that my job was secure, and even to have had some time off to manage the emotional and practical impact on my life. They didn't give me this, and I needed the money for my own housing. My sole objective was to be with my children, and I was determined to make this happen. I probably came across as very strong and self-sufficient, but that is because I had to be. With hindsight, there were so many signs that my employer could have picked up on to reach in. I would urge all employers, especially during the pandemic, to take notice if a colleague's productivity changes or work patterns change. Ultimately, be there for them and support them, because we all have a duty to end domestic abuse. Jane's company did not have a domestic abuse policy. Hart's Domestic Abuse Helpline is calling on all companies to have a policy in place so that employees feel able to talk, knowing there will be appropriate support. In the months that followed the March lockdown, Hart's Domestic Abuse Helpline saw a 32% increase in calls and emails. After a drop in numbers in August, there was an increase again in September and October, averaging around 32% more calls and emails over both months compared to last year. The spokeswoman for the charity said, "As we near the end of lockdown two, we want to remind everyone that they are not alone. We have a duty to respond to domestic abuse, and employers have a vital role in doing this responsibly and safely."
St Albans Museum glows orange in support of domestic abuse campaign. St Albans Museum has been lit up in orange to raise awareness of action against gender-based violence. Women's organisation, St Albans and District Soroptimists, teamed up with the museum to illuminate the building for International Day for the Elimination of Violence Against Women, which also marked the start of hashtag 16 Days of Activism. Jane Slatter, Communications Officer for Soroptimist International St Albans and District, told the Hearts ad, "As a women's organisation, we've always been involved with all things that concern women and girls, and when it comes to domestic abuse, there's not a Soroptimist club in the country that doesn't support their local women's refuge. It is at the heart of the work that we do." Soroptimists, as part of a non-governmental organisation at the United Nations, seek equality, peace and international goodwill for women. "We've got members all over the world," Jane added. "These 16 days are quite a concerted effort on behalf of women all over the world to raise awareness on all aspects of domestic abuse." The club, which internationally is celebrating its centenary this year, work closely with women's charities based across St Albans District, including St Albans and Hartsmere Women's Refuge, SAHWR. Speaking of the Soroptimists' relationship with charities in the area, Jane said, "We can't do everything, but we can point people in the right direction." St Albans and District's Soroptimists hope to continue lighting the museum in orange hues annually to raise awareness for the Action Against Gender-Based Violence campaign and to turn awareness into action. Jane said, "Because we've done it this year, we'll definitely be able to do it next year. There are loads of buildings going orange. It's caught people's imaginations." With face-to-face awareness and fundraising suspended due to the pandemic, Jane is focusing on the positives. "This is something we can do. Buildings up and down the country were lit up in solidarity of the movement." For more information on St Albans Soroptimists, visit their website.
Has the lockdown been doing its job in Hertfordshire? The national coronavirus lockdown has been doing its job in Hertfordshire, according to the county's Director of Public Health. Jim McManus said that the November lockdown was needed to see a downward trend of cases in the county. Mr McManus had been speaking in a press briefing on Friday, the day after the announcement that Hertfordshire would be placed in Tier 2 when the country comes out of lockdown on December the 2nd. Before the announcement, Mr McManus told the media that the past week's data would show how much of an impact lockdown has had on the spread of COVID-19 in Hertfordshire. The latest government figures shows that cases in all 10 districts in the county have seen a drop in the 7 days to November 23rd. And two areas, Stevenage and North Hertfordshire, have now dropped just below 100 cases per 100,000 of population, with Decorum and St Albans close to dropping below the mark as well. Mr McManus said on Friday, "My view would be, pessimistic though I was, that the lockdown is doing its job, I think. We needed this to kind of start it. That's the dropping cases. The task is, can we keep this going?" He explained that restrictions in Tier 2, such as a ban on different household mixing indoors, will deliver some yield in some of our largest populations who are getting infected. "So I think that's a hopeful sign, because the measures are different and they have been tweaked," Mr McManus said. You add that together with our continuing work on retail, safer shopping, safer restaurants and hospitality, that should deliver the results we want. That is, unless people decide to abandon the behaviours. But what we know in Hertfordshire is that the bulk of our residents have focused on doing what they can do safely. Despite a drop in cases in Hertfordshire during the lockdown, Hertfordshire County Council leader David Williams said it is highly unlikely Hertfordshire will drop down to Tier 1 before Christmas, adding any change in tiers may not be for some time. Councillor Williams said Tier 2 is about being able to hold infection rates during this winter period. "This really positive news is the extent of our case rates, which have come down in Hertfordshire. And just about a week ago, we were looking at a rate of around 170 cases per 100,000 population, which has now come down to 136. So it has come down rapidly. We were heading upwards pretty quickly in September and October, and that was a consequence of Tier 1. We need to see how the newly refined Tier 2 works for us and whether we can still see a reduction in numbers over that period."
And now the list of deaths as announced in this week's Hertfordshire Advertiser. Ernest Clive Chattin. Derek James Hall, aged 85. John McKay, 69. Shirley Marina Smith, 84. Pat Woodgate, 80. Stephen James Mays, 58. Now, a little more music from Gothby, followed by John Cushing reading the national radio listings.
Here are some radio listening choices to cheer you through the dull December days and dark nights. And we'll start with Saturday, December 5th. And a drama is the first choice. Passenger List at 2:45 p.m. on Radio 4 is a mystery thriller concerning the disappearance of a plane over the Atlantic. Political Thinking with Nick Robinson is at 5:30 p.m. on Radio 4. These non-combative interviews are always interesting and often revealing. An opera marathon is on Radio 3 at 6:30 p.m. with Prokofiev's War and Peace, broadcast from the New York Met. It lasts 3 3/4 hours. For an evening of nostalgic humour, Comedy Controller, presented by Bill Oddie. You can hear classic comedy from the 20th century at 7 p.m. on Radio 4 Extra. And The Wonderful World of Kerris Matthews is at 9 p.m. on Radio 2. Sunday, December 6th, and it brings us an eye thriller called I Promise. It concerns an idealistic hacker and cryptocurrency and can be heard at 3 p.m. on Radio 4. Words of Music on Radio 3 at 5:30 p.m. is entitled Pastiche and Parody, featuring the late John Sessions reading works by Shakespeare and Craig Brown and Bernard Shaw, amongst others. Judi Dench and Michael Williams are Mr. and Mrs. Nobody in Keith Waterhouse's adaptation of a very funny Diary of a Nobody. It can be heard 8 p.m. on Radio 4 Extra. Desert Island Discs with the late Vera Lynn follows at 9 p.m. And the final of the 34th Young Chorister of the Year is at 9 p.m. on Radio 2. On to those programmes then that are serialised through the week, Monday to Friday, at the same time each day on the same radio station. Book of the Week on Radio 4 at 9:45 a.m. and then again at 12:30 is How to Make the World Add Up, written and read by the Radio 4 regular Tim Harford. He reveals how we can confidently evaluate the statistical claims that surround us. The 15-minute drama on Radio 4 at 10:45 a.m. and 7:45 p.m. each night is a new season of The Pursuits of Darlene Files, the drama about a young married couple with learning disabilities. Composer of the Week on Radio 3 at noon each day, George Benjamin. The Midnight Library by Matt Haig is this week's novel, read by Bryony Hannah on Radio 4 at just after midday each day, Monday to Friday, on Radio 4. An intriguing story of a woman living in Bedford with her cat who finds herself in the Midnight Library, a place between life and death. 1:45 p.m. on Radio 4, again each day, sees the return of A History of the World in 100 Objects. And the Classic FM concert with John Suchet at 8 p.m. each night presents a week of Christmas favourites for Advent. On to the rest of the programmes that we think you might enjoy this coming week, starting with Monday, December 7th, and two programmes of topical interest. The Nature Cure, in the Untold series at 11 a.m. on Radio 4, tells of a father and son who study the healing power of plants on their Cornish farm and find that their findings are urgently needed. And at 11:30 on Radio 4, Tim Harford continues to report on the race for a COVID vaccine in How to Vaccinate the World. Graham Greene novel, The Power and the Glory, is dramatised in two parts on Radio 4 Extra, starting at 3 p.m, with part two at the same time on Tuesday. 3 p.m. on Radio 4, still on Monday, a new series of the musical quiz Counterpart at 3 p.m, followed at 3:30 by the food programme, and this week it looks at the secret life of chocolate. Stay on Radio 4 for Faith in Music at 4 p.m. The subject is the Tudor Age composer Thomas Tallis. And the last ever episode of I'm Sorry I Haven't a Clue with Tim Brooke Taylor is on at 6:30 p.m. on Radio 4. A performance of Verdi's Requiem comes from La Scala, Milan at 7:30 p.m. on Radio 3. It's sung in memory of all those who've died from COVID-19. And The Blues Show with Kerris Matthews is at 9 p.m. on Radio 2. From a busy Monday to an even more plentiful Tuesday, December 8th, starting at 11 a.m. on Radio 4 with Don't Log Off, when people around the world say how COVID-19 has changed their lives. My Albion follows at 11:30 a.m, looking at the enduring symbols of Albion. To commemorate the 40th anniversary of the death of John Lennon, Radio 4 at 2:15 is broadcasting the play A Week in the Life by Dick Clements and Ian Le Frenay. that is set during Lennon's memorial service. Great Lives at 4pm on Radio 4 looks at the life of Queen Catherine Parr. She's nominated by the historical novelist Philippa Gregory. Three varied programmes for the early evening can be found on Radio 4 Extra. 6:30pm, Soul Music, Chopin's Ballad No. 1 in G minor. Followed at 7pm by The Goon Show. And at 7:30pm, the legal comedy, Legal, Decent, Honest and Truthful. Radio 4 at 8pm has Death of a Headmaster, a remembrance of Philip Lawrence by one of his pupils. It's followed, as usual on a Tuesday, by In Touch at 8:40pm. And The Jazz Show with Jamie Cullum rounds it off 9pm on Radio 2. The second of the Wreath Lectures is on Wednesday, December 9th at 9am on Radio 4, entitled From Credit Crisis to Resilience. Mark Carney, the former governor of the Bank of England, revisits the 2008 financial crisis. The 2:15pm drama on Radio 4 is Where This Service Will Connect, a further episode in the romance of fellow passengers Susie and David. For some Danish comfort and contentment, Sandy Toksvig's Hygge is on Radio 4 at 6:30pm. A recital by pianist Andreas Schiff on Radio 3 at 7:30. He plays works by Janáček and Schumann. And The Folk Show with Mark Radcliffe is on Radio 2 at 9pm, rounding off Wednesday. An interesting drama can be heard on Thursday, December 10th at 2:15 on Radio 4. Operation Crucible is set in Sheffield in 1940. The Luftwaffe are attempting to destroy the steel industry and four steelworkers are sheltering in a hotel. Open Country is at 3pm on Radio 4. A singer-songwriter shows how the landscape of the Somerset Levels has influenced her music. And The Country Show with Bob Harris on Radio 2 at 9pm. And Friday, December 11th brings us part two of an intriguing mystery drama. London Particular at 2:15 on Radio 4 continues the story of Alice, who while travelling on the tube sees her missing brother passing on another train. She's contacted by a group of time travellers. If you missed part one, you can catch up on BBC Sounds. Part three is then next week. 6:30pm on Radio 4 sees the return of Dead Ringers when John Coleshaw and fellow satirists cast an up-to-the-minute eye on breaking news. Radio 4 Extra has two comedies for early evening, 7pm The Navy Lark and 7:30pm King Street Junior. There's an evening of easy music listening on offer from Radio 2 starting at 7pm with Tony Blackburn's Golden Hour, 8pm Sounds of the 80s, guests and forgotten gems of that period, and 10pm Fern Cotton has a nostalgic playlist, reminisces and guests in Sounds of the 90s. And if you missed A History of the World in 100 Objects, there is an omnibus edition at 9pm on Radio 4. As ever, we wish you an enjoyable week and a safe week of radio listening. And whatever is happening in the outside world, we hope this selection will also keep you entertained.
The pandemic has affected all of our lives greatly. After the first lockdown, we perhaps thought that life might return to what some people have euphemistically referred to as the new normal. Now, as the second lockdown finishes and living in Tier 2 begins, Rob Pearman talked to Sarah Keeling, curator of St Albans Museum and Gallery, about the prospects for the two venues.
When we went into lockdown in late March, both of the city's museums were forced to close their doors. Now, at the height of the lockdown, Sarah Keeling, curator of St Albans Museum and Gallery, recorded a fascinating audio tour of the whole building, from the very first entrance to the final gallery space at the back on the top floor. That audio tour can still be heard, by the way, on the podcast page of radioverulam.com, but more on that later. Now, Sarah's with me today and is going to help us catch up on what's happened since. Sarah, the museum is now open to visitors. When did you open?
We've been open for about 6 weeks now, and a Verulamian museum has also been open for about a month. So we've managed to get both of our museums reopened.
We'll come back to Verulamian Museum a little bit later, but you say you're open, but are you entirely open or did you open bit by bit?
We first of all opened up the front of the building and the cafe, just because, of course, that's the easier space to open right at the front. So while we were still doing some work behind the scenes, we opened the cafe because, of course, one of the big things is we want people to come back in the museum, but we also need some money to be able to do what we're doing. So that was the first stage. And then the second stage was we'd had a temporary wall put in and we removed that and we opened the whole building. The only part of the building that we still haven't been able to open are the cells, because of course they have an incredibly narrow corridor, so we haven't found a way to do that safely, but we're still thinking about it. You can come down the new stairs and you can come to our Western Gallery space and you can have a look at the honours boards from a distance. But that whole corridor we've had to block off just because there's no way that people can pass. And it's so long, there's no way that you can tell if someone's going to be coming towards you. So, yeah, that one's a bit of a challenge for her.
Those stairs, what you call the new stairs, which is the stairway, having gone through towards the courtroom, you then turn right and there's the staircase down to the Western Gallery. Is that sort of left and right COVID defined? Keep on one side?
Yeah, absolutely. All the staircases have left and right arrows on them to keep people separate. Downstairs, it's only the one gallery, so you go down the stairs and then you can go into the gallery, and that's quite a large space you can be in. Upstairs, if you follow the arrows up, it then actually takes you in a one-way system around the top floor just to make sure that you can see everything but also keep everyone safe.
Yes, yeah, because you've only got one staircase down and then you've only got the main staircase up. Is the lift being used if needed?
The lift is being used, and we're just asking people to only use it either on their own or with their own household bubble, so no sharing the lift, but it is being used.
You said the cafeteria that was first to open, and you can now go from there with food and drink through to the courtroom.
Yeah, so when we were able to open the rest of the building, that was one of the things that we were doing some work on behind the scenes, was getting the courtroom, rearranging the furniture in there and making sure that everything was safe and cleanable. So you can now either sit outside if you can brave the cold or come into the courtroom.
So you've made the building COVID compliant as long as visitors follow the rules.
People are being very good mostly, and what we're very lucky in this museum is because it's quite high ceilings and it is quite large, there is room for people to pass by. And of course, everyone has to wear a mask when they're in the museum, as with other spaces as well. But we're finding most people are behaving really well in here, which is nice to see.
As curator, you are responsible for what is on display. That's simplistically and crudely put.
Yep, that is part of my job, yes. And the main part, you're right. What's on display and how we display it.
The fixed exhibitions, the thousands of years of history, which you, when you go through from the cafeteria, if you look immediately right or left, you see that those panels which are illuminated and objects in there as well. That's your basic historical background, isn't it?
We call that the city that went up the hill. So it starts with the history of Verulamium at the bottom of the hill and comes up to St Albans.
And then you've got a choice. You either go through to the courtroom if you've got a cup of coffee in your hand, or you go down the stairs to the Western Gallery, or you go upstairs to the other things. Let's go downstairs first. You use the Western Gallery as your main exhibition area?
Yeah, that's our headline exhibition space. At the moment, what's in there are, we've put St Albans Picture House, our own mini cinema, with some films by Arthur Melbourne Cooper, who was a St Albans filmmaker in the really early part of the 20th century. So these are films that are over 100 years old, but a lot of them are stop motion animation. So it's toys moving around. There's a film called The Dream of Toyland, so it looks a bit like Toy Story. That wasn't an exhibition we had as a big plan. Obviously, all of our exhibition programme had to be completely changed during lockdown. We have a very exciting exhibition called Cabaret Mechanical Marvels coming in November, but we had a bit of a gap. So we thought, we've got these amazing films, let's put them on display. And so people have been coming and sitting and having a watch of those in there.
How long would you sit there?
There are various films. I think the whole run of the loop is about 45 or 50 minutes, but each individual film tends to be either 5 or 10 minutes. I think Dream of Toyland is the longest, and that's 20 minutes, and it just plays round on a cycle. But there's a sign on the wall so you can see which one you're in. So Dream of Toyland's the longest, but my absolute favourite is one where there's a lady who ends up flying on an umbrella as if she's Mary Poppins, but before Mary Poppins. So I don't know if Travers had seen Arthur Melbourne Cooper's film when she was writing Mary Poppins.
Give us a little bit of history, because Arthur Melville Cooper is related to St Albans. I mean, he's got connections with St Albans, hasn't he?
Absolutely. So he owned the first cinema where the Odyssey is now. He had a cinema there that was called the Alpha. But he was an absolutely pioneering filmmaker and best known, as I say, for stop motion. So he was making films between about 1896 and 1915. So we're talking really early cinema here. And he made advertising films for people, but he also made his own short films. And there's a lot of humour in a lot of his films. They're quite funny. And you forget that you're watching something that's more than 100 years old when you watch them. I've popped in a couple of times when I'm working in the museum, and I'm always amazed by how small children just still will react to Dream of Toyland just the way they react to Toy Story, even though there's no sound, of course. It's just images. But yeah, he was a really important person, and he's someone I'm sure we'll be picking up again later, but he seemed like a great example of a story that we could tell in that space quite easily during this period.
Let's go back to the lockdown. You had exhibitions planned at that point, didn't you?
We did, absolutely. So we had a full exhibition plan for this year. Exactly the week we went into lockdown, we had just taken our science exhibition off display, and the next week we should have been receiving all of the artworks for the Hertfordshire Open Show. So that was really sad for us because we thought this summer we were going to have an amazing exhibition of local artists and they'd all been selected and they were all really excited to come. And of course, all of that had to stop. And we moved that exhibition entirely online. It was entirely on our website and the University of Hertfordshire hosted it as well. That was a very quick change, but then we had other exhibitions coming up. And so one of the things that myself and David Thorold, our other curator, have been doing in lockdown is trying to rearrange some of those exhibitions. Some of them we've put off till later. So we were supposed to be having an exhibition this summer called Chronicles of History, which would have brought some of the medieval manuscripts written at the cathedral back to St. Albans. So David's been working very hard with all of the people who were going to lend manuscripts to see if we can move that to next year. Because, of course, we were on lockdown. All of the other museums were on lockdown. Some staff were furloughed, some staff were in. So it's been quite a complicated picture. And that's why when we reopened, the Western Gallery was empty effectively because we'd moved that exhibition to next year because we couldn't just shift it a little bit with these things. You have to get permission. So, you know, you can't just say, can you open a month later? We have permission for this summer or we have permission for next summer. So it's been quite a challenge. But as I say, we do have a new exhibition opening on the 13th of November down there. But for the moment, we wanted to make sure that there was something everywhere in our building, and so we put out a knob on people.
And the 13th of November, that's going to be what is that exhibition?
It's called Cabaret Mechanical Marvels. It's going to be a really lovely, colourful exhibition. We're working with Cabaret Mechanical Theatre, who make automata. And if you don't know what an automata is, it's a machine that, with a press or a turn of a handle, will make a sculpture or a statue move in some way. So one of the ones I know that they're going to be bringing is a lion tamer. And when you press the button, the lion eats the lion tamer's head. But they have these historical ones and they have modern models and some of them are famous paintings that move. And we've been working with them because they have a lot of craftspeople who make these really skilled people. And we, of course, in St. Albans have a thing called the Salomon Collection, which is a collection of tools. So we will also be bringing out some of our woodworking and watchmaking tools to show how these things are made. So I've been really grateful to Cabaret Mechanical Theatre for working with us because, of course, touching buttons and turning handles is a very unnerving thing at the moment. So we've been working really hard on how to make that safe and how to find ways that people can interact without touching directly. So, yeah, that's been a big challenge, but I'm excited to see how people experience it.
Although we can get all this information by going to your website, which is a critical route of information for all of us, the cinema one is ending about November the 4th.
Yeah, that's it, November the 4th.
And then you have a gap, enough gap to get the next one in. So the cinema till the 4th, and then the 13th of November, you have these. The Victorians love those machines, didn't they? Those automata.
Absolutely. Cabaret Mechanical Theatre used to be based in Covent Garden, and I remember seeing some of these models in Covent Garden in London when I was a child, and I just being absolutely fascinated by how they worked. I mean, they're beautiful things to look at anyway, but then because they're clockwork and they're kind of handmade, you can actually see how all of the different bits connect to each other. And we're working with them to hopefully have some small paper kits so that any children who want to have a go at making their own one will be able to do that as well, to really see how they work.
You talked about bringing the Salomon collection out of storage, and that's one of your problems, isn't it? You've got so much in storage that you really would like to have a building 10 times as big as the one you've got.
Yes, and I think even if we did, we'd still have things in storage. I mean, you know, I've never found a museum that doesn't have more in their store than on display. I think I've said before on your programme, it's really lovely here in St. Albans that we have the changing programme so that we can keep bringing different things out. And the Salomon tool collection is a really good example. Some people remember the galleries at the old museum, which are very static, and people loved seeing the tools, but they always stayed the same. So it was always the same things that you could see on display. And since they went off display, the tools have been used. We've worked with school groups and university groups and artists and all sorts of people and researchers have come and looked at them. But I'm quite excited to get a bit of them on display here in the new museum. The Salomon collection is absolutely enormous and covers every type of craft under the sun. Wheelwrights, coopers who make barrels, saddlers, clockmakers, beekeeping equipment, all sorts. So we had to focus a little bit. So I've gone for woodworking and for watchmaking because they kind of match with the skills that you need to make an automata.
When you come out of the Western Gallery and go back upstairs and then up the main staircase, the grand staircase, past the various portraits of famous people, St. Albans connections on the wall,
yeah.
And I'm not sure everybody realises that you can go round the corner and look at the screen and tap and find out who all about each one of them.
So at the moment, there isn't a screen because, of course, touching screens is one of the challenges. So what you can do at the moment is there's a big board at the bottom that has all the pictures and names, but then we've also, there's a QR code there and you can come on our website to read all about them. We're talking to a lot of other museums at the moment about how we manage touchscreens because they're a real challenge.
Oh, it's all such fun, isn't it? Okay, well, you go up the staircase past those. Then you come to an area in which there are various displayed items.
Yes, St. Albans On Demand.
On Demand, I mean, explain that again for me.
So St. Albans On Demand, the display is always there, but the individual objects change because people can ask us what they would like to display. So at the moment, just before lockdown, we'd put in a display from the St. Albans RNLI. So even though St. Albans obviously has no coast, we do have our own Lifeboat Institute chapter, and they were celebrating their 100th anniversary this year. So one of the things that's in there is some information about them and their fundraising over the last 100 years. But yeah, it changes at all different times, depending on who asks me to put an object on display. Is there a story that people want to have on display? So another thing that we have at the moment is some placards from the Black Lives Matter protest that happened over lockdown. So those are on display until the end of October. And we've also just put on display two pieces of sculpture from our collection. We've been working with Art UK, who are an amazing organisation and website, who previously photographed every single oil painting in a public collection in the UK and put them on their website. And so the last couple of years, they've been doing a similar thing with sculpture. So we have put two of the pieces that they've photographed into that display.
And if you really want to see something and you know it's there somewhere in the museum's archives, what do you do? Do you drop it on a card or something? How do you ask for it?
So at the moment, we're suggesting emails are the best way. You can email museum@stalbans.gov.uk. But if you want to write it on a piece of paper and leave it with our front of house team, they'll pass it on. Of course, you can search our collections on our website, so you can have a look at what we do have if there's something you want to ask for. And as with the RNLI, sometimes groups or individuals come to us with things that they have in their own collections that they want to share. Or even we've had people just say, there's an anniversary coming up. Are you doing something about that? So last year, we celebrated the anniversary of the D-Day landings because we have in our collection the St. Albans Normandy Veterans Association flag. So someone said, what are you doing about this? So we went through our collections and found that and were able to bring it out. So if anyone sends in an idea, I can't always guarantee that I'll fit all of them in, but we're always looking for new ideas. And I'm always excited to hear from members of the public who want us to put something on display.
You mentioned individuals or groups. Presumably at the moment you can't have groups of school children coming around in the way that you might have done in the past.
No, not in the museum up in town. We are having school visits at Verulamium because the way that museum is opening is slightly different, which we can talk about later. So we have had our first school visits from them, which is really lovely.
Going on from that area and bypassing, which is a criminal thing to do, that most wonderful room at the front.
Well, so funnily enough, now with our one-way system, that's actually where you come out. So you come up into St. Albans On Demand and you turn left and we take you round through our galleries and then we finish in the beautiful assembly room, which is a spectacular room, you're right. And we've still got our map out on the floor there. And we've added a few little bits and pieces to help people spot things in that room actually at the moment. But yeah, that's your finishing point at the moment. And instead, you turn left and you go down the glass link and towards our latest exhibition, which just opened on the 10th of October.
And that glass link is passing by the window that looks back over the courtroom, isn't it?
That's right. So you look down to your left onto the courtroom and you look out to your right and you can see Marketplace and the cathedral and the clock tower.
Okay, and then you carry on straight down through some more doors, I guess.
Yep.
And there is your final exhibition?
Yes. So in the Keeper's Gallery, we now have Looking Back, Looking Forwards, which celebrates 175 years of SAHARS, which is a wonderful acronym. And I'm going to do my absolute best to get this right. They are the St. Albans and Hertfordshire Architectural and Archaeological Society, which is a little bit of a tongue twister.
Known as Ark and Arc.
Ark and Arc, or SAHARS, tend to be how they're known for short. So that's our local history society, and they're celebrating their 175th anniversary this year, which is absolutely amazing. They're one of the longest running societies in the country. And they were involved in the excavations down at Verulamium, in starting the museum down there. They were involved in starting the museum on Hatfield Road, the old county museum. that became the Museum of St Albans. They've helped us fundraise and also with programming for the new museum here in town. They've been involved in absolutely every area you can think of in the history. And my favourite fact in the exhibition, if you think about what St Albans would be like without them, is that they've saved the clock tower from being pulled down much, much earlier in their life and its life. So if we didn't have Sahas, we might well not have a clock tower. Yeah, which is quite amazing to think about. But a lot of the members of Sahas were the people who were involved in setting up the original museum. And if you look at lists of membership of Sahas and then you look at the lists of people who gave objects to the museum or who were involved in those early days, there's a lot of crossover. So one of the things that we've been able to do in this exhibition is bring out a few of the objects that came in early. And they had a particular interest in archaeology, so particularly there. But also without them, we might well not exist at all.
And the exhibition that you've got down in the...
Keeper's Gallery.
The Keeper's Gallery, sorry. Was it mainly pictures or was it three-dimensional stuff? Or?
It's a mix of both. So there's some objects from my collection. I'd say there's some archaeology. They've been involved in quite a lot of books, including some really beautiful ones. So we've got some of those out. There's a really wonderful picture of one of the big brasses in the cathedral that the Sahas were involved in preserving and recording. And then actually they've taken over the end of the corridor as well with some information about their current members and what they're doing at the moment and lectures. So, you know, as you walk around, you'll continue to find out their story, and then you'll be brought out at the end into the assembly room, a beautiful jewel of a room. If I'm allowed to have a favourite, my favourite object in the exhibition is an incredible model of the clock tower that was made by a student called Beth Jones at the University of Hertfordshire as her final year project. And she very valiantly managed to continue working on it during, again, lockdown when she struggled to get into the workshop. So she's made a scale model of the clock tower and it's absolutely perfect, right down to Gabriel, the bell at the top. So if you have never been able to get up the clock tower, do come and see, because you can peer in to the top floor on her model. So that's a really lovely thing that we've been able to put on display, a beautiful jewel of a room.
Sarah, we're going to run out of time. Let me just ask you a quick question about Verulamium Museum. That is also open, but slightly different terms, yeah?
It is also open, but you do need to book because that space is slightly smaller and the ceilings are slightly lower. We just need to manage the people in there. So if you go on our website, you can book a ticket. If you're a resident, it's still free. If you're not a resident of the city and district, you will pay when you arrive. But it's just important to book your ticket. And as I say, we are having schools in, and when we have a school in, we're having to close the rest of the museum. So do make sure you check our website and book your slot. But we'd love to see you there.
I think the slots are hourly.
They are, yeah, that's right, on the hour.
One thing I did want to ask, you got some money from this government fund for to help support?
Yeah, we were enormously grateful. So we received about £150,000 from the Cultural Recovery Grant. And what that is there to do is to support the income that we haven't been able to get this year. So it's an absolute amazing thing to have, because, of course, to be able to keep our staff working here and to be able to keep putting on exhibitions, we do need that money. And so we are really lucky that we did get that grant. And it's kind of a big sigh of relief from us. We're still not in an easy position, but it does mean that we know for the moment we can carry on working and carry on being open for the people of St Albans.
I would certainly encourage everybody to go there, but also to look at your website, because there's so much information in your website, which is
stalbansmuseums.org.uk. And yeah, we're keeping on updating that and trying to keep as much on it as possible, because we know that not everyone is going to be able to come out still at the moment. So there are still virtual exhibitions on there, and we're still trying to keep our blog and our social media up to date, so that if you can't come and visit us in person, hopefully you can still learn something about the history of St Albans.
Sarah, thanks very much for your time. Much appreciated.
Thank you, Rob.
Now, another from our series, London Beyond Sight. This week, Marcel Jenkins describes St Pancras Railway Station. This is one of the many fascinating items that can be found on the Vocalise London Beyond Sight website.
Hello, my name is Marcel Jenkins, and I was one of the 8,000 torchbearers for the London 2012 Olympic Games. I carried the Olympic torch in the London Borough of Lewisham, just past Lewisham Hospital, where my son was born. I was nominated by one of the committee from the Friends of Blythe Hill Fields, a small community group I've been involved with for over 7 years in various roles, including chair, treasurer, webmaster, and photographer. Blythe Hill Fields is a small yet remarkable park in southeast London, nestled between Catford, Honor Oak Park, and Forest Hill, with incredible views across the City of London. The Friends spend time organising activities on the park for local people to get involved, including planting and hedge clearing. We also organise an annual community festival featuring the best creative and cultural talent from across the borough. I'm passionate about contributing to my local community, doing my bit to help make where we live a nicer place for everyone to be. Being selected to carry the Olympic torch was a real honour and privilege. I first got to know St Pancras Station in the 1990s when I was working for Arts Council England East Midlands in Loughborough, and whenever I came down to London for a meeting, this amazing station was my gateway to the city. It's audacious, fabulously ornate, and even today still full of surprises. I don't think there's anything else like it in London, and I absolutely love it. Later in my career, whilst managing a touring hip-hop dance company at Sadler's Wells Theatre, many of our tours started from either Euston, King's Cross or St Pancras. And occasionally, if I had time once the artists had been dispatched, I'd just stand there on the other side of the Euston Road, marvelling at this extraordinary long red brick building rising 4 stories high, its narrow arched windows divided by slender stone pillars, like a big church, not a station at all. Then the steeply pitched grey slate roof, with 2 tiers of windows, each with its own narrow pitched roof and stone finial. And to top it all, 2 impressive towers with small turrets, surmounted by slender spires like a fantasy fairy castle, and dripping with decoration in pale stone. And there's a clock tower at the end, like a small Big Ben. The front facade of St Pancras Station is the most crazy building. It's as if a child had been let loose to add whatever they wanted, unconstrained by any single architectural device. But somehow it all works brilliantly, producing a glorious Rococo edifice with a character all of its own. Perhaps the architect, Sir George Gilbert Scott, got carried away. When the building was opened in 1877, he remarked rather sniffily that it was a building too good for its purpose. He actually designed the facade, not the station behind it, and his brief was to provide a luxury hotel as well as an imposing frontage for the Midland Railway's brand new station. As a young man, Sir George had travelled extensively in Europe, becoming fascinated by the medieval buildings in France and Italy, many of them Gothic churches. During his career, he restored a number of cathedrals in this style, as well as designing churches, schools, workhouses and asylums. 800 buildings in England alone, including the Foreign Office and the Albert Memorial. St Pancras was one of his last works, and he thought it one of his best, and I have to say I agree. The windows on each story are subtly different, but all have arches in bold stripes of red and cream. These arches are round on some stories and pointed on others. The windows are plain on the bottom story, then divided vertically by a narrow stone pillar, while those at the top are clustered in threes, each with its own arch, like those you'd find high above the nave in Norman churches. Wrought iron balconies on stout stone corbels define the lower stories, and a sturdy line of low stone pillars forms another balcony along the base of the roof. Behind this stone balcony, the slate roof slopes steeply upwards, punctuated by the 2 rows of dormer windows, their high finials giving this part of the building a very un-English look. Yet above on the skyline stands a row of tall brick Victorian chimneys. The roofline is defined by 2 tall towers at the left end, marking the entrances to the hotel, and the square clock tower on the right. This tower supports a large gilded clock on each face, and there's a weathercock on top of its central spire. The 2 towers at the hotel end are decorated by shaped gables, which rise in a series of steps to the top, frothing with pale stone like icing on a cake, and there are more of these at intervals along the length of the building. The corners of all 3 towers are marked with slender spires of metal or brick, topped with high finials or gilded weathercocks, and the centre of each tower rises in a tall metal pyramid, topped off with a finial in the shape of a fleur-de-lis. The whole edifice is unashamedly grand, and made all the more impressive by being not only set back from the street, but above it. When the station was designed, it was decided the trains would run in above ground level, to allow the tracks to clear the Regent's Canal in the north. So although the hotel entrance to the left opens onto the street, the facade curves away from the road, and the original station entrance is actually some 15 metres above ground level. A broad paved roadway in front of it rises up from the left like a long ramp to allow taxis to pick up and set down passengers before sweeping round in a grand curve and heading back down to the street. The ground floor area below the station was originally used to stow barrels of beer brought down in their hundreds by goods trains from Burton-on-Trent. I love the red brick, rough and grainy when you touch it. Its solidity, presence and texture are so reassuring you can almost feel its pulse. The building is so different from all the modern, cold, soulless, homogenised glass buildings in London, which seem to get built in a moment and never have a real sense of permanence about them. St Pancras is solid and traditional and will no doubt outlive its more contemporary neighbours across the London skyline. It wasn't always like that, though. In the 1960s, after Thomas Beeching shredded the railways, British Rail was keen to demolish St Pancras. The station became run down and shabby, and it took a vigorous campaign led by historians such as Niklaus Pevsner and the poet and conservationist John Betjeman to save the building, which was subsequently listed Grade 1, the same status as the Houses of Parliament and Westminster Abbey. Then, when the Channel Tunnel opened, it was decided that St Pancras should be the terminus for the Eurostar train service to France. £800 million was spent on redeveloping the station, and today Sir George Gilbert Scott's building is the gateway to a sleek, modern international terminus with striking sculptures, high-end shops, and an air of understated luxury. No longer a building too good for its purpose, it's come into its own at last. If you ever have the chance to wander in and around St Pancras, take your time to immerse yourself in the experience. See if you can feel its pulse.
More music now, and here's the full-length version of Words by Gothby. I hope you enjoyed the New York vocalised description of the Empire State Building last month. This time, Leonard Marcus, a children's book expert, describes the Brooklyn Bridge.
Hello, I'm Leonard Marcus. I live in Brooklyn, and it's my pleasure to describe for you an icon of my borough and of the city, the Brooklyn Bridge, the first bridge to connect Manhattan and Brooklyn. It was built in 1883, and before that, the only way to get between these two boroughs was by ferry. The bridge was designed by John Roebling and constructed under his supervision, and later his son and daughter-in-law, Washington and Emily Roebling. Today, many tall bridges span the East River, and of course the city is filled with skyscrapers. But in 1883, The tallest building in New York City was the spire of Trinity Church on Wall Street at 281 feet. The two towers of the Brooklyn Bridge rose to 276 feet, only 5 feet shorter. So the bridge immediately became a dominant element of the city's skyline. The Brooklyn Bridge is a suspension bridge, which means the roadway across the span is hanging from suspension cables. It was the longest suspension bridge in the world when it was built, and for about 20 years after. The section that extends above the river is 1,500 feet long, which is about a third of a mile. John Roebling was able to build such a long bridge at that time because he had invented and perfected a kind of steel wire to use. Before this, suspension bridges used wire made of iron. There are four main cables on the bridge, each appearing to be a solid cable 15 inches in diameter. But in reality, that 15 inches is made up of over 5,000 strands of steel wire that are braided and woven together for maximum strength. The bridge is 85 feet wide, with six lanes for traffic, three in each direction. Suspended above the traffic is a wooden footbridge, a promenade 15 feet wide for people to walk or bike across. If you walk to the center of the bridge, you are standing 135 feet above the surface of the East River. To understand the structure of the Brooklyn Bridge, I'm going to ask you to do a few things with your hands and arms while sitting at a table, like a dining room or kitchen table. Or, if that's not possible at this moment, imagine you are sitting at a table. Place your hands on the table directly in front of you, palms down, thumbs touching. Now, raise both hands about 6 inches, and then extend your arms to the left and right as far as you can, and drop them down to the tabletop. Where your hands end are the ends of the bridge. Let's say Manhattan on the left and Brooklyn on the right. That gentle arc from where your hands began down to the tabletop on the left and right is the arc of the roadbed of the Brooklyn Bridge. Now bring your elbows in and place them on the table directly in front of you, with your fingers pointing straight up at the ceiling. Your arms now represent the main vertical parts of the bridge, the towers that support the gray suspension cables. These towers are actually standing in the East River, close to the shore on each side. The suspension cables are anchored on each shore, then gently rise to the tops of the towers. The cables then continue between the tops of the towers, which, remember, are your fingertips. But they do not go straight across from one tower to the other. Instead, they appear to hang down between the towers in a graceful curve, which gives the bridge so much of its poetic beauty. Besides these main cables, there are over 1,500 vertical cables called suspenders attached to the main cables. These drop straight down and are attached near the roadbed. When you walk or drive across the bridge, all these cables create a kind of elegant spider web of lines. You can rest your arms now while I describe the two towers, as if you are facing them directly while driving or walking across the bridge. The towers are built of large gray granite blocks, quarried in Maine, and as I said before, each tower is 276 feet tall. But the towers are not solid walls of stone. Instead, each tower has twin openings within it, tall, narrow, open spaces with arched tops that come to a point. You find this same shape in the Gothic windows of many Christian churches. I love the fact that the bridge is both eminently practical in connecting Manhattan and Brooklyn, while feeling cathedral-like and monumental in its inspiring design. The Brooklyn Bridge is a national historic landmark and, of course, a New York City landmark. In 1883, New Yorkers marveled at what technology was capable of, and the bridge became a symbol of optimism and the future. Today, the bridge continues to inspire New Yorkers, whether poets, artists, writers, photographers, or just people on their way to work. I hope you get a chance to walk across the bridge and feel inspired yourself.
As we are now entering the first few days of Tier 2 after the second lockdown, Rob Pearman talked to Denise Parsons, manager of St. Albans Business Improvement District. That's BID to you and me, about the future for the hospitality and retail sectors in our area leading up to Christmas and into 2021.
I think everybody in St Albans knows that Denise Parsons is the manager of St Albans BID, the Business Improvement District, because she's been on the radio many, many times and told us all about the work of St Albans BID. But I want to focus with you today, Denise, on what's going to happen. Well, it's next week we come out of the second lockdown. Is St Albans ready for it?
I think so. I would say it's eagerly awaiting the end of lockdown, the sequel, as I like to call it. Yes, I think our businesses are very much ready. Obviously, it's a hugely busy time of year for them this time of year. It's a time when obviously retail especially and hospitality, the money that they make over the next few weeks is what tides them over at the beginning of next year. And that's in a normal trading year. So you can imagine how much they need it right now.
And even if we were in tier two, all shops are going to be allowed to open, aren't they?
They are, yes, yeah. Obviously, we're just waiting to find out what tier we will be in. There are some implications for hospitality as well, you know, as the tiers go up. But yes, all our shops will be open and they're going to be really pleased to see you, for one thing. But also, they have been ready with regards to COVID planning right since the first lockdown. So if you walk in any of the, especially the independent traders in the town, they've got free PPE. They will be wearing masks and they will have done all their COVID risk assessments. They've had to be on top of it. The government guidelines are quite clear. And I think that side of things isn't an issue. They really want their customers to feel safe because they are their customers. And you've got much more of a personal relationship with your independent retailers. So they want you to feel safe because they're building relationships. They're not just a fast cash sale or whatever. They're looking for their customers to come back again and again. So it's obviously in their interest to be extremely hot on the new protocols.
They'd be daft if they weren't prepared for us to go in, because we're not going to go in if we don't feel comfortable.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
Cafes are open, or does that depend on what tier we're in?
Yeah, obviously our cafes have been open for takeaway all through the lockdown too anyway. But again, yes, there will be further restrictions on hospitality depending on what tier we're going to end up in. Obviously, if we're in the lowest tier, we're fine. Obviously, they reduce covers with the amount of space, but that's back to at least a playing field that they've had to get used to over the summer. But obviously, if we go into higher tiers, yes, there's some talk of you can only drink with a substantial meal. There's been a lot of chat about what constitutes a substantial meal. For some, it could be a plate of chips. It could be a sit down with a three-course meal. Who knows? But yeah, so there's all those kind of things that could come up in the higher tiers.
And if we're in the tier that allows pubs to be open through now till 11 o'clock, we're only serving up to 10, which is going to apply across all of the tier, whatever we're in. Do people feel that makes sense, that extra hour but no more?
Yeah, I think it does, because I think it's been very well publicised in the national press. I haven't personally seen it so much locally, but with such a rigid cut-off time of 10 o'clock, everyone's got to be out, invariably everyone has to leave at the same time, and that can cause extra problems and chaos. Whereas actually, if it's back to kind of what you would expect, your normal kind of pub closing time of 11, some people will still leave at 10, some will leave at 10 past, half past, and that way you stagger any impact of everyone leaving at once as well.
That's the theory. That's the logic behind it, isn't it?
Yeah, well, it seems a sensible. And obviously, it may be 11 o'clock and everyone chucks out at the same time. We don't know. Obviously, people are going to be keen to get back in the pubs, having missed them, especially this time of year. But at least it's a bit more of a sensible option, I think.
Now, if somebody can't go into the shops for whatever reason, or you know, they've got particular issues that they have to be very careful with.
Yeah.
Obviously, the second thing for them to do is to go online.
Yes, yeah.
Do you think the majority of independent retailers have now got an online presence?
Oh, yes. I think there's very few. In fact, I don't think there's any that I'm aware of. I'm not saying there isn't any, but there's none I'm aware of that haven't got an online site. We did have a few more traditional bricks and mortar type shops that hadn't got websites, or at least hadn't got a modern functioning website during the first lockdown, but they've all got that sorted out within the last few months. And I think there is a reason to buy online still from your local retailers, because not only are you supporting the local economy, but you're also with a trusted website. I don't know if you saw, there was an OWL email that came round about online shopping. So obviously we're all price conscious and looking for a bargain. So you may come across a website you've never ever heard of, and it may have a super duper price on whatever it is that you want. But that could be a scam. It could be the service may be really poor. You might wait weeks for your item to come. Whereas using an online version of your local independent shop, you know that that is secure. So I think that's a really good safety reason, if you like.
And if you're not happy with something, you're quite close to being able to go back and sort them out.
Yeah, well, because there's nothing worse, is there? You buy something from a big chain and then you have repeated problems either getting it delivered or getting it returned. You've all waited a month or 2 months for a credit note that hasn't come, all that kind of stuff. Whereas actually with your local independent retailers, customer service is at the top of their list and they'll ring you back. They'll sort it out. You know, you can talk to a real person.
And we've all had examples of scams in our own life. I'm sure I can still think of the last two.
There's so many around. There are so many around. I mean, even they're getting really bold and, you know, actually just ringing places up as well. Not only the emails that you can kind of look at and think, oh, that looks a bit dodgy, but they're relentless and ruthless. They really are.
That's great news that the majority of, if not all, our local independent traders are now online. How do we find out what their online address is?
Okay, so you've got a couple of options. So on the Enjoy St Albans website, which is the main St Albans website, we've got a directory of all our shops and hospitality within the town centre. We've also got a page that's called Offers, that is a wider district offering of about 300, probably a bit more now, offers, all from local businesses, whether their offer isn't necessarily an offer as in money off, but it's showing you that they'll do click and collect, they'll do deliveries. Could be a virtual shopping experience if you're not sure what to buy. A lot of the shops will sit up on Zoom and show you around the shop virtually. There's an awful lot of offers going on out there at the moment. And obviously, lots of Christmas offers starting to come through now as well.
Sure, but if I'm not a great user of online shopping, and certainly if I haven't used it locally, as it were, with local shops, where do I go? Do I go to the Beat website? Do I go to...
No, it's the Enjoy St Albans website.
Which is enjoystalbans.com. .com. Fine, and that gives you...
Yeah, and if you go to shopping, one of the main menu headers, and that will give you all the directory listings, which include the websites and the phone numbers for the town centre shops as well.
Great, so that gives us lots of opportunities to find out who's doing it.
Obviously, we assume that everyone's following social media these days. I know there are sometimes people that don't, but it's just social media is kind of where the action is, really, you know, especially as far as shopping. So we've got the Shop St Albans Instagram and Facebook accounts, which have so much information on them as far as shopping's concerned. And we've even got some kind of more bespoke gift guides that have been done as blogs, which are on the Enjoy St Albans website under blogs. So if you're looking for ideas, for inspiration, you can read through our gift guides and there's a direct link to that individual shop as well.
So even if, like me, you're an old fogey and you don't like social media very much, you limit your use of it. There are people around like that, including me. I go to enjoystalbans.com and I'm safe. I've got it all.
Yes, you are extremely safe, yeah. But also, if you're very much not wanting to go the tech route, if you know the shop, you can still look up their phone number. Give them a ring.
Yeah, there isn't yet a phone book of websites, is there?
No, but I guess if you're not keen on tech, you may not want to go the online route anyway, but you can pick up the phone and speak to the shop and they will sort anything out for you. You know, you ring them and say, I'm looking for X, Y, and Z, and they'll say, oh, we've got this, we've got that. There's more old-fashioned route if you want it as well.
Absolutely. Okay, great. So the key thing is enjoystalbans.com for information.
Yep, absolutely.
Go to the shops because they're going to be open from next week.
Yeah, from Wednesday. Yeah.
Go back to your shops that you used to love.
Yes.
And hopefully get a cup of coffee on the way as well.
Absolutely, yeah.
If you're looking for a meal, let's hope we can get some meals in the restaurants and the pubs up to the whatever the rules are.
Absolutely. And don't forget, in between times, there's always markets as well. So market is a very safe environment as far as trading is concerned. You're outdoors and it's much easier to social distance. So there are lots of markets from the 30th of November right through to the 24th of December.
Fantastic. Well, we're all going to take care. We're all going to be sensible because we don't want to go back into another lockdown.
No.
So let's do it wisely, but let's do it. And And I love this. The decorations are all up the high street now, all over the shops, aren't they?
Yeah, we've had fun this week. We've still got a few more bits and pieces to come out, but we've got all the main lights are obviously, and the animated pieces are out. We're still sorting out a couple more Christmas trees here and there. But yes, from the businesses, you know, who funded all the Christmas lights, they very much wanted to give people something to smile about. So as you walk through the town centre, whether you're doing exercise or whether you're just shopping or whatever you are there for, at least it still feels like Christmas. I can't see anybody can't smile at seeing a reindeer on a roof. Who couldn't smile at that?
Well, I know you've got a lot of work to do, Denise, you and everybody else. Thanks very much.
You're welcome.
Cheers, thanks.
Thank you, Rob. Finally, let's have a look at events and birth dates in the past that happened in this upcoming week. On the 6th of December in 1922, the Irish Free State was created under the terms of the Anglo-Irish Treaty. Northern Ireland chose to opt out of that agreement. On the 7th of December, 1732, the Royal Opera House in London opened its doors for the very first time. In 1941 on that date, Japan launched an attack on the US Pacific Fleet's base at Pearl Harbor, killing 2,403 people and compelling the United States to enter World War II. On the 8th of December, in 1980, former Beatle John Lennon was shot dead outside his New York apartment. In the year 2000, the Florida Supreme Court ordered an immediate hand count of disputed votes in the USA election between Republican candidate George W. Bush and Democratic candidate Al Gore. On the 9th of December in 1960, the very first episode of Coronation Street was broadcast. In 1979, on the 9th of December, smallpox was declared eradicated everywhere in the world. On the 10th of December in 1903, Marie Curie received the Nobel Prize for Physics for her pioneering research on radioactivity, the first woman to be awarded such a prize. And in 1948, the United Nations General Assembly adopted the Universal Declaration on Human Rights. On the 11th of December in 1936, King Edward VIII abdicated the throne in order to marry American divorcee Wallace Simpson. And on the 12th of December in 1901, Marconi sent the first transatlantic radio signal from Cornwall to Newfoundland in Canada. And here are some well-known people whose birth dates fall this week. On the 6th of December 1920, popular jazz pianist Dave Brubeck, who was best known for Take Five and Blue Rondo a la Turque, was born in Concord, California. On the 7th of December in 1980, John Terry, currently the coach at Aston Villa Football Club, was born. He has previously captained Chelsea as well as the England national team. In 1943, on the 8th of December, James Douglas Morrison, better known as Jim Morrison, lead vocalist of the rock band The Doors, whose greatest hits include Hello, I Love You and Light My Fire, was born in Florida, United States. In 1934, on the 9th of December, British actress Dame Judi Dench was born in York. Known for her numerous and varied stage roles and for her work in television and films, in 1995 she took the role of James Bond's boss, M, in GoldenEye, the first of several Bond movies in which she appeared. On the 10th of December in 1815, Ada Lovelace, the 19th century mathematician and world's first computer programmer, was born. On the 11th of December in 1943 in Denver, Colorado, US politician John Kerry was born. He served in the Senate from 1985 to 2013 and was the Democratic Party's nominee for president in 2004. On the 12th of December in 1863, Norwegian painter and printmaker Edvard Munch was born. He is widely known for his iconic pre-expressionist painting, The Scream. And that finishes up this edition of Primary. My thanks to Gilly, Deborah, Jane, Christine, Jess, Andy, Keith and David for reading the news. To Angela for providing the radio listings and John who read them. Thanks also to Marcel Jenkins and Leonard Marcus. Neil and Karen for the week in history, and as always, to Rob Pearman for all his help. Primary will be back in 4 weeks' time. Let me take this opportunity to wish you the best and safest Christmas possible. Please remember to return your USB stick and wallet after use, and please stay well and safe at home. Goodbye.